Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listeners of our community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. And the views expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. And I just want to mention, Paul was mentioning Greg Palast. He played a segment from the last hour. This tomorrow on Labor's Worldview TV on Comcast Channel 6 or AbandonedPublicTelevision.org, we'll be playing two short films by Greg Palast, one about the stolen elections in Florida in 2000, the stolen presidential elections, and the stolen presidential elections in Mexico in 2006, both involving the same company, Choice Point, that rigged the vote. So tune in for that tomorrow, Sunday, 4 to 5 p.m., Labor's Worldview TV, Comcast Channel 6. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization, GEO Union, and at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. We got a caller calling in, John Ryman from Oakland, California. Going to be talking about what's been happening in Greece this last week. Oshi is the Greek word for no, and that's what the Greek people told the neoliberal troika, the European Union Central Bank. And the battle goes on there, and John's going to be talking about some problems with that struggle there.
This is getting exciting.
Indeed.
A lot of people don't see this, but this is a very pivotal moment in history where the people are standing up at the hundreds of thousands level and saying no, and not only to austerity, but also to what's probably going to be happening with their own government situation, Syriza. So this is going to be a very interesting hour today.
Indeed, indeed. So we want to start this, news segment out with Gus, and he's got a local story that's actually getting some national attention here.
Yeah, this story actually was brewing a few months ago. A couple of pieces came out in local newspapers, but recently CNN has been doing their own research, and they published a huge expose a couple of days ago about racism and exploitation of athletes at the University of Illinois. So we have two separate types of things going on here, whereas in players have accused coaches and the administration of racism, and also players have accused coaches and other people of exploiting them and using them when they're injured. And just to give the people listening something of what's going on, some of the things, one of the black women basketball players who used to play for the university said that one of the assistant coaches will refer to race all the time and would tell her that her culture was poison or toxic to the starting team, which was predominantly white. So, and during road games, the players say they were segregated. Black players were separated from the white ones in hotel rooms.
Right. Wow.
And it was so bad that four players from this past season transferred out of the program at the University of Illinois to other schools. Now, here's something that a lot of people aren't also talking about is the exploitation of the players themselves. And the players and their families have complained to CNN that they were pressured to play through injuries and go far beyond the typical tough nature of college sports. In one case, a women's basketball player says she was forced to play with an injured toe that ended up being diagnosed as a broken foot. Athletes on the football team also complained that injuries were not taken seriously. One recalling a time when coaches threatened from the sidelines that he would lose his scholarship if he limped across the field with a knee injury. Overall, students and parents on both teams said that there was a culture of coaches bullying students with frequent threats to take away scholarships and also racism. So this doesn't sound very, this doesn't sound unique to me. This is the same thing we were dealing with last summer with the Stephen Salida issue in terms of power struggles and hegemony and white supremacy going on at the University of Illinois. I mean, this is the exact same thing. So what you have here is a culture, a foundation of inequality that is being pushed not only through academics, but through sports and a group we don't usually talk about a lot, which is the undergraduate population.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how as a university, all universities around the country for the most part, but particularly the University of Illinois here locally, has become more and more corporatized over the years. It just seems like I keep bumping it every time we talk about something dealing with racism and stuff. Neoliberalism is right there in the mix, so to speak, you know.
It's definitely in the mix because what you have happening is that these players are being forced to play through injuries. They're playing beyond what they're supposed to be doing based on their scholarships outside of the racism aspect of it. They're being exploited for monetary purposes by the people who are investing in these types of sports. I mean, this thing is huge. We talked about it last year about the Northwestern players. Trying to unionize and trying to recognize that we should be able to have a voice at the table to talk about our conditions as athletes who are, they're producing billions of dollars of revenue that they're only seeing less than 1% of. And the exact same thing is happening here. It's where these people are trying to exploiting these players in various ways. And the players actually stood up and said, I'm not taking anymore. Some of them used flight as a method of resistance. Mm-hmm. They left the team. Some of them used legalism and are currently in the state of suing the university.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just standing up saying, I'm not taking this anymore. So there are different forms of resistance that the players are taking in this racism and exploitation.
And that University Athletic Association, I mean, they're flush with cash. I mean, huge, budgets and outlandish salaries. And while the rest of the university is being told that they have to take cuts, you know.
Yeah, and just to add in for the people, because I want to make sure people understand how serious this is. I only gave you one example of the racism, but the players actually have told CNN about this thing called the dog pound.
Right.
Yes. So for those that haven't read the story, if you get a chance to go to the CNN.com page.
Go to CNN.
Yeah, it's an amazing.
We don't normally recommend CNN as a source, but occasionally, like a broken clock, right?
They've got a 5-minute video up there that is all about this. They talk to the players typically didn't want to talk too much.
Yeah.
But they talked to three or four groups of parents. The players, and it's quite amazing. There's an in-depth story there that, like Gus says, they did their own research on this.
Okay,
this is amazing. Very surprising. Yeah, like you said, this is a unique situation for us to be advocating going to CNN.
So what's the doghouse?
The dog pound.
I'm sorry.
So several players and the parents now. So this is what I love about this story and the expose of it is that they're talking to both players and parents.
Right.
That's huge that they have that connection going on. So both of them told CNN that separate practices were held for the team. One practice group was majority black and called the dog pound, which the players understood to mean they were not in favor. The other practice group was majority white, made up for the starters on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition, tension between those groups was encouraged, and parents wrote in letters of complaint to the university in April. So they already knew about this, and they were sending things, and the administration was already aware of these things going on, and it continued to happen. The players said those in the dog pound were called crabs.
Crabs.
Yep. Which on a conference call, seven other players explained like this. I quote, crabs can never get out of a bucket because they always pull each other down. That is how he explained it in practice. They all just climb on top of each other and pull each other down. Like bums, we are just dragging everybody down. And that's what was referred to as the dog pound or the black players on the women's basketball team at the University of Illinois.
Call them West Side Ghetto.
Yeah,
also.
West Side, types of racial slurs against their culture, ghettos, things like that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah,
you know.
Now, one assistant basketball coach has left the university. Was he actually fired?
That's a good question.
One has left, but actually, and I'll get into this a little bit about this NCPA, the National College Players Association. This was the organization that kind of came through with the Northwestern University football team and athletes up there at Northwestern that were trying to unionize, and that's still going on. And the NCPA, National College Players Association, wrote a letter to the chancellor here. The university has had a internal review going on, but they didn't find half of this information on their own. That's why CNN is doing the investigation. Anyway, the NCPA wrote a letter to Chancellor Phyllis Weiss this week calling for them to fire athletic director Mike Thomas, football coach Tim Beckman, and also the basketball coach, women's basketball coach. Women's basketball is where most of these instances went on.
Mm-hmm.
As Gus was saying, seven former women's basketball players have filed a lawsuit against the university, but also a former women's soccer player has filed suit over medical treatment, and three former football players have lodged complaints about their treatment too. So this NCPA, led by Ramoji Huma, is calling on the university to fire both the athletic director, football coach, and women's basketball coach.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
This is, I mean, it's, and what's interesting about this is that there, and as I mentioned before, people were already talking about this months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there was already talk about it. The administration already knew about it. The parents had written the letters a long time ago. So this was something that was already on the campus at this point. Now the fact that this is a national story,
mm-hmm.
and this is in the same relation to what's going on with the AAUP censure of the university because of the Stephen Salida incident.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then there's all this other stuff going on the campus in terms of enrollment numbers for African Americans plummeting at the, them bringing people in at the undergraduate level. Graduate level is already embarrassing, but now undergraduate is plummeting. I mean, there is a huge foundational problem at the center mm-hmm. of the University mm-hmm. of Illinois that the administration refused to address.
Now, Phyllis Weiss's idea of diversity, if I'm not mistaken, is more rich foreign students.
Of course.
As opposed to African American and working class, people that are residents of the state of Illinois or, mm-hmm. you know, around the country.
So she would rather spend billions of dollars, you know, because that's exactly what's equaling up to after all these years going and recruiting international students, then going up into Southside Chicago and going into those high schools and doing recruitment things there,
mm-hmm.
or going into urban cities and actually going after African American, Latino, Latina students. Mm-hmm. They don't want to do that.
Or even here in Champaign Urbana.
Exactly, Champaign Urbana.
I mean, there used to be guidelines, if I remember correctly, going back, you know, I remember hearing about these back, you know, some 30 years ago in the 80s, that there were preferences for U of I admissions, at least that started after World War II, that actually focused on recruiting people of minority groups as well as people from different lower classes of all races and stuff, because they thought that was more diverse and that they would give actually preference to people that lived in local community as well as in the state of Illinois, and then they expanded it out, you know, nationwide and stuff. I don't see that being practiced anymore at all. You know, I bet you, I wonder what the student ratio is as far as local, how many undergrads at the U of I currently are actually from the city of Champaign-Urbana? That'd be interesting to know.
That's a good question.
And then break it down by class and see, you know, I mean, that would be really revealing, I think.
They don't want that study to come out.
No. So what else we got as far as news today or for this week?
I can do a different story here about a friend of mine up in Wisconsin sent me a headline, and it said basically Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, gets schooled by his neighbor. And actually they're talking about Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton and saying he's a classic tax and spend liberal. And it says, so why is this state walloping Scott Walker's Wisconsin in terms of economic growth? So Dayton was elected in 2010, so was Scott Walker, I believe, about that time.
Mm-hmm.
And up in Minnesota, Governor Dayton has relentlessly pursued liberal policies, and Minnesota's economy is going gangbusters while Wisconsin's job growth has fallen to 44th among the 50 states.
Wow.
Dayton's got a progressive Congress up there, senators and House and stuff like that. But it says that Minnesota gains are not because Mark Dayton has overpowered the state with his political acumen, but it's because his skill has a clear agenda. He's unyielding, and it's not pie in the sky, great society adventurism. He's raised the minimum wage. He's significantly increased taxes on the top 2% of wage earners to close a budget shortfall, and he's raising money in investments in infrastructures. They've also started Minnesota Healthcare up there, MN Sure, and these are all in contrast to Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And also another interesting contrast of what's happening here in Illinois with Governor Rauner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've been paying attention this week, there's two different courts have come out with two different opinions on what should happen with the state workers here, the fact that there's no budget. One court actually said that the state cannot pay the workers without a budget, that the workers won't get paid at all. And another court came out the other day and said that the state has an obligation, has contracts with these workers, and has to pay them. So we don't know. Actually, the state comptroller this week on Friday said that she's going to come out and actually pay them on Wednesday. So that's kind of in contrast to Rauner and stuff like that.
Now, the comptroller is a Republican, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, comptroller is a Republican.
And she's the one that backed off from earlier in the year, I think, something in regards to the fair share withholdings or something. She refused to do what Rauner ordered her to do.
Right, right. So a Cook County judge on Tuesday went along with the 1991 decree, which holds without a budget, the Constitution bars spending money. But Leslie Munger, the Republican appointed by Rauner to the post of comptroller, writes the checks that pay the government's bills, won an appellate court ruling to stop enforcement of the order. And now on Thursday, 13 labor unions took the issue to St. Clair County on the other end of the state near St. Louis. There, the judge ruled the state would violate the Constitution without if they didn't pay them. Mm-hmm. There's also some issue that if payment was made, they would only be paid at the federal minimum wage. So all of this comes around to say what's been happening to Governor Rauner's approval ratings, you know. And at this point, there was a recent poll in southern Illinois that found that Rauner had an approval rating of just 29.3%,
mm-hmm.
a disapproval rating of 43.9%. And this is in a district that originally voted for Rauner 63-31% back in
the election. Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, you know. Back in June 20th, a Chicago-based firm, Ogden & Fry, came up and they said that only 35.7% of the voters in the whole state approve of him, 46.7% disapprove. So
okay.
Back when he first started his term, there was a polls out that 52% gave him an approval rating and 23% disapproving. So his approval ratings are plummeting with each and every week.
Yeah, but my question is, where, you know, the Democrats have a supermajority in the House and the Senate. Why don't they call an emergency session and pass a budget? I mean, isn't that possible?
I think they did pass a budget and Rauner vetoed it.
Okay, but if they have a supermajority, they can override his veto.
They should be able to override his veto, right?
If they get all the Democrats to vote accordingly, you know.
Yeah,
right.
That's the problem, getting them all on the same page at the time, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, I heard that Rauner's targeted our local state Senator Scott Bennett, $1 million bounty on him, basically, you know, to try to knock him out in the next election. It's like, man, I didn't know he, I mean, I could see him going after Carol Ammons, but, you know, Scott Bennett, I mean, you know, I haven't heard anything real bad about him, but nothing real spectacular either. So it's kind of interesting.
Scott Bennett was on Big Al's community chat here on WEFT radio this past week on Wednesday evening. Hopefully you had a chance to catch that.
I think maybe Rauner caught it and that's what got him, like,
yes.
He's like, he's on community radio?
Yeah.
Oh no, he's gotta go.
Okay. So what else is new, Gus? Give me new,
A lot of stuff going on. Everybody knows summertime and people are, and, you know, trying to take a rest, especially the students are out of school. And what's the one thing the students want to do who are able to are to work? They want to work. They want to find jobs. Unfortunately, where we are right now, and, you know, people that know me know I love to bring my data, and I got tons of data here to show that summer joblessness for U.S. teens is now at a record level. Let me give you some data. And if you had a chance to see this chart, I wish I could show it to you. Since 2000, the share of youth ages 16 to 19 working during the summer months fell from nearly 52% to less than 27% today.
Wow.
The largest drop in employment for any age group throughout the period. Since 2000, so 15 years, that's the largest drop. It gets worse. Year-round employment for youth dropped from 45% to 27% since 2000, according to the Labor Department. Employment for those aged 20 to 24, and everybody knows that's a key demographic for this country, especially in trying to establish a lifestyle and avoid debt, things like that. 20 to 24 also plummeted during this period, dropping by 9.8%. So over 3.23 million teenagers wished to work but could not find work.
And why do you think that is? Is that because more and more older people are having to take these service sector jobs?
They have, and not only that, right. They have to continue working because of the crackdown and the war against the working class. Mm-hmm. Because they're taking away
pensions.
Livable mid pensions. They're taking away livable mid-skilled jobs with benefits. They're taking them away so that these older people have to take these jobs.
Right.
I mean, and we're talking about folks, and not even that, we can go into the people coming out of college who can't find work.
Right.
They can't, I forgot the statistic, but they say over half of the people who graduate from college can't get a job in their major field.
And I heard, as of last year anyway, I don't know what the recent data shows, but that college graduates were the highest group of unemployed out there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this is a crippling crisis in the country right now, and the fact that teenagers can't find work, because the old saying goes, when back in the 60s and 70s, you know, when you were younger, you would see teenagers working in McDonald's, you would see them working in Burger King, trying to make some summer money.
Yeah.
But now, everybody that you see when you go into McDonald's, now you're starting to see 40, 50, and 60-year-olds.
60-year-olds, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, all the time.
This is a really scary scenario.
College graduates working at Starbucks and Jimmy John's.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
This can't go on.
I mean, because this is an explosive mix for the future. I mean, you know.
Yeah, because it's been, I mean, the consistent trend from 2000 has only, there hasn't been any increases. It's only been a bit of a stagnation, but the rest of it has been regressive. The numbers are dropping ridiculously. I mean, this is scary.
We talk about that often on this program, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor in this country. It's getting so outrageous. It's as bad as it was back in 1929.
Yep. You know? Yep. And we know what happened that year, but, you know, I got a quick public service announcement. We'll take a quick music break. Unrequited, Two Lovers, Capitalism and Socialism in Three Acts, a play by Susan Parenti will be playing, Saturday, July 18th at 2 p.m. at the Red Herring at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon Street in Urbana, Illinois. And it's a talk back will follow the play. It's a $10 suggested donation, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. This play had a premiere earlier in the year in Chicago. And again, that's Unrequited, Two Lovers, Capitalism and Socialism in Three Acts by Susan Parenti. So we're going to take a quick music break here. And you're listening to the World Labor Hour, and we'll be right back.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And does a shadow of the men who send their guns to the wars that are fought in places where the business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, on TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that become...
Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Good morning, this is John calling.
Good morning, John.
Hey, John.
John Ryman here on the phone calling from Oakland, California. And so John, you wanted to call in today and talk about what's been going happening in Greece. We had a news story at the top of the hour talking about the no vote in Greece against the austerity plan and everything. And you wanted to, I mean, this is really quite a pivotal moment in world, working class affairs. But you see some problems within this, within Greece. I mean, that's why you wanted to call in today. So I'll just let you take it from there.
Okay. Well, you know, of course, the way it's pictured in the papers is all the Greek workers, they don't work and they get an early retirement and they want to have their cake and eat it too, is the way it's pictured in all the, in the capitalist press everywhere. But really what you're seeing in Greece is an example of the crisis of capitalism itself. And I'd like to just back up and read one item, a news story from the Financial Times of a few days ago. This is what they describe. They say government coffers about to run dry, the economy in recession, the people hurting from draconian austerity program, and international banks and money managers unwilling to underwrite any more loans or bonds, and the government unable to pay off its debts. And you might think that that's talking about Greece, but in fact, it's Puerto Rico.
Oh, yes, that's been a kind of an unreported story out there.
Right. Yeah,
exactly. So it's what you're seeing is the contradictions of capitalism, which are felt everywhere. And the number one contradiction is the tendency for the rate of profit to fall, or one of the main contradictions, and that's a whole other topic to discuss. But anyway, that's striking hardest in the parts of the world and in the countries where capitalism is the weakest. And capitalism has always failed the Greek working class. And you saw a collapse in the rate of profit there starting in the late 70s and the 80s. And then what happened was when Greece went into the Eurozone, then French and German banks started buying up Greek debt, Greek bonds, at an inflated interest rates. And the interest rates were higher there than they were in Germany and France. But they didn't have to worry about that because it was all one currency. So they didn't have to worry about the currency collapsing.
And a lot of these bonds were issued, if I'm not mistaken, to help finance Greece's entry into the Eurozone?
Right. And then when it was discovered that the government couldn't pay off the bonds anymore, these speculators then they turned to their governments and said, well, now the Greek workers have to pay for it. And so that's what you're seeing. That's what you're seeing now with the austerity program. And of course, it's really no different. It's just a lot more sharp and more severe than what we're seeing all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there a time period there where Goldman Sachs actually falsified monetary records for Greece to help get them into the Eurozone?
That's right. Exactly. And then they continued, they and their collaborators in the government continued to falsify those monetary records. And I'm sure that if you looked at any government in the world, including the United States, you would see the same kind of falsification, collaboration, and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, and also I think it's interesting to compare Greece, how the International Monetary Fund is treating Greece as compared to the Ukraine.
Right. Because they're wanting, but you see, the IMF is now saying, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't squeeze the Greek economy so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think part of it is because Greece really right now is the epicenter in the pushback of the world's working class against making the workers pay for this wild gambling spree. Mm-hmm. On the part of finance capital all around the world.
Yeah, and there's also the issue, too, I understand, is a lot of billionaire oligarchs in Greece haven't paid, even just some non-billion, some regular millionaires have not paid taxes, almost forever. I mean, they always have some ways of getting out of paying their taxes, which of course hurts revenues and stuff. And, you know, there's that issue and also a host of other things. Oh, and the International Monetary Fund, wanting them to cut their budgets under the last government, except for military spending. They wanted to increase military spending. And isn't Greece one of the largest, spends the most on its military than any other EU member?
They're now saying, though, that they want Greece to reduce its military expenditure.
Oh, well, they've shifted their tune on that one. Okay.
But of course, what that's going to mean is that Greece becomes militarily dependent on the major EU.
Ah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Or rather, Greek capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's kind of the background. So what do you think of this new government since it was elected, the Syriza? I mean, they've been going back and forth negotiations, you know, prior to this no vote against the austerity package that was supposedly the last and final offer from the European Union. What's your analysis of how the new Syriza government, relatively new Syriza government's been handling things?
If I could just back up, there's one background piece that I think is really important.
Okay.
And that is, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal a week or two ago in which described the small growth of the economy in Spain and also Portugal. And it said that they are that growth is due to their reducing their costs.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, in Spain and Portugal, the austerity programs have succeeded in reducing the wages so much that it becomes a little bit more profitable for international capital to invest in Spain and Portugal than, let's say, maybe in France or Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, their economies are growing a little bit. But, of course, what that means is that that is going to put pressure on the French and German workers to cut their pay.
Mm-hmm.
That is really what this struggle, or a big part of what this struggle in Greece is all about, is to force the Greek workers into that competition, that what we well know is a race to the bottom, and then use that as a means of further pressuring the French and the German workers.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in the end, it can't even save capitalism, because that same article that I mentioned from the Wall Street Journal, they say a slide in consumer spending has put a drag on Portugal's recovery. And that's the same thing everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's an attempt to increase the rate of profit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happened, because of the traditions of the Greek working class, then there was increased resistance to the austerity. And at one point, this Syriza, which was first just a coalition and is now a party, developed out of that and actually, won the last election.
And before this all this austerity hit Greece, I think they were only like about 5-6% of the vote they'd usually get.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And we should think about that in terms of the United States also, by the way, of course. It's a very different country,
mm-hmm.
and capitalism is nowhere near in the crisis that it is in Greece. But still, you see how they skyrocketed from just a few percentage points up to
the majority,
actually winning
yeah.
an election.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the top, what you had is a layer of intellectuals and people that were, in my opinion, they were not really part of the working class movement. And even those who call themselves Marxists, mm-hmm. like Varoufakis, who until recently was the head of the finance minister in Greece, that didn't really see Marxism and socialism as a living, breathing thing, how to connect the long-term goal of socialism with the day-to-day struggles.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And with the steps that are necessary now to head in that direction, it was just some abstract philosophical goal or something. And so what happened was they had no strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, when they came into office, they debated, they negotiated and negotiated and negotiated with what was called the Troika, you know, with the heads of capitalism throughout the EU, but they weren't really mobilizing any power from below.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's that quote from George Shultz. He was from Bechtel, and I think he was in, what was it, the Reagan administration?
Yes.
Or maybe the Bush. Anyway, he had said that negotiation without the specter of power really is just a euphemism for capitulating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see what you're saying, because, you know, they didn't, they started negotiations. I mean, then we saw as time progressed that it's like, they weren't getting anywhere. I mean, it seemed like almost that they went there hoping to expect the European Union bankers to all of a sudden, convert from their hardcore neoliberalism to all of a sudden wanting to grant Greece a Marshall Plan. I mean, were they really that naive?
I think that they initially Tsipras, the Greek prime minister, had this idea that he was going to divide the EU heads of state.
Mm-hmm.
And that the hardliners, like, he could split off the hardliners like Merkel in Germany from some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at one point he bragged that he had done that.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, nothing of the sort happened.
Yeah, they were playing good cop, bad cop with him, is what they were doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But unless the police force is under pressure, there's no reason that the good cops should be good cops.
Yes,
don't be good cops,
indeed.
Bad cops,
indeed.
And so, and that is enough. So he didn't have that specter of power. He wasn't the government. The Syriza was not mobilizing the working class in Greece itself to fight to take over the banks and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Another point, incidentally, that I was just reading today. Did you know that the Greek merchant marine fleet makes up almost 20% of the world's merchant fleet?
20% of the world's merchant fleet? I knew it was huge for the economy of Greece, but I didn't know that it was that large. Wow, for the world.
That's them a huge lever,
mm-hmm.
potentially.
Yes.
Anyway, there were certain red lines that they said they would not cross. And then one of them was privatizing the port of Piraeus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was one of the earliest ones that they capitulated on, because they didn't have that specter of power, number one, domestically.
Mm-hmm.
That is, a mobilized and aroused working class in Greece. Basically, the impression that I have, and I mean, I'm not there, so obviously a lot of what I can say is just very general, but from the outside, you weren't hearing about a real mobilization of the Greek working class during those months. The other point is this. You know, like in Germany, the public opinion is the strongest against Greece because they've been subject to this massive propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
But also in Germany, there's been a bit of a strike wave.
Yes.
I think there was 350,000 worker days lost due to strikes since the beginning of the year.
Wow.
And what are they striking against? The exact same thing that the Greek workers are fighting against.
Yes.
You know, making the German workers subject to the laws of the capitalist marketplace.
Yeah, in recent years, of course, the German postal service was privatized, the German railroads were privatized, and I think the most recent strike was with the train workers. I think everyone from the conductors down to the maintenance people and stuff. And supposedly they had quite a bit of public sympathy, I heard.
So it seems to me that another part, while you're mobilizing your own working class, that the other part of that strategy could have been to mobilize groups of workers in Greece to go to visit those striking workers in Germany,
mm-hmm.
go to visit the workers in France, Portugal, Spain, and so on, and explain, look, we are in the forefront of what you yourselves are fighting against, and we need to join together.
Okay, our co-host Gus would like to make a comment.
I think you hit on something earlier about why that hasn't happened. We have to really be very critical of what Syriza is doing right now. Just looking at some of the points of their counterproposal to the austerity measures, some of the things that they have in here, a gradual increase in the retirement age from 62 to 67, the elimination of a solidarity grant for poor pensions, and the 50% increase in health costs for pensioners, cuts to public sector salaries imposed by unifying the wage grid for government workers, the completion of all currently planned privatizations, including regional airports and the ports of Piraeus, and some other places. I mean, and that's just a few of the things that they put on the table to counter the austerity measures. So, I mean, I think.
But they are austerity measures.
Yeah, that's
exactly
the thing.
That's my point.
Yeah,
right?
it doesn't sound like much of a fight back to me.
Exactly. That's my point. What we have going on here, and what I love seeing so much from different news outlets and not the national propaganda media, is that the workers are actually holding these movements and these demonstrations themselves outside of what Syriza is doing. And I think that they're really starting to see what Syriza has on the table for them. And they're going to start understanding that this is not just against austerity and against capitalism, neoliberalism, but it's against this, like you say, this capitulation, this co-optation of so-called leftist groups who become rulers in a system that is fundamentally designed to be unequal and restrictive to people. I mean,
You know, I'm reminded when you read that and say that's designed to counter austerity, reminded of the comment by the murdered Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, who said, "You don't fight capitalism with capitalism.
Exactly.
You fight capitalism with basic socialism."
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay.
Great quote.
What do you think's going to happen, John, if you look into your little crystal ball for Greece here in the coming months?
You know, I just don't know.
It's so uncertain. Yeah, it's all in flux.
I'm not there. I understand that the revolutionary left is now starting to get together.
Mm-hmm.
And
which are about a third, I heard, of Syriza's coalition.
Yeah, but that's that kind of left platform. But from what I understand, they're kind of a left platform in the way, mainly in name.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that the parliament just passed Tsipras's austerity program. you know, there's a whole other issue that tends to get ignored on the left here that I think we really, really have to pay attention to. And that's the immigration issue.
Oh, yes.
And I just saw in Germany, and I forget, I'm not sure where it was, a significant mobilization in one town against an immigrant community there, you know, a community of refugees from Syria and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a group of Nazis or neo-Nazis marched into that and were applauded by the other people there.
Mm. That's disturbing. Most of the time I see, you know, neo-Nazis protesting in Germany, they're met with the 10 times number of anti-Nazi protesters. Yeah.
And, of course, Greece is one of the main, if not the main, entry point of the refugees.
From the Middle East?
From the Middle East and from North Africa.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I also understand that the anti-immigrant feeling in Greece is actually stronger than in any other EU country.
Interesting.
So there's a real danger there that I think we really have to, that we really cannot ignore. And that is, if this struggle, and I understand that it's not defeated at this point,
mm-hmm.
but if it does meet with a serious setback, then there's the danger of demoralization setting in. And under those circumstances, as you saw in Yugoslavia years ago, then a whole layer of society could turn to or could be receptive to the anti-immigrant, anti-refugee propaganda there.
Yeah, and also the fascist group Golden Dawn, which right now is kind of on the ropes, but could make a comeback. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And
yeah.
From what I understand, that's not on the perspectives immediately.
Yes.
But it definitely, I think, is a danger. And again, not being there, it's impossible to really know how, but it just seems to me that that socialists really have to make a connection between the issue of the needs of the refugees in Greece and in the EU and the struggle against austerity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another point to be made as far as that, and that is, you know, you see a kind of worldwide wave of like chauvinism and xenophobia, and part of that is the rise of the of this fascist group, the Islamic State,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and those sorts of groups. And it seems to me, if the revolutionary left really made it built a base in Greece, and the movement there linked up with the refugees, that would then provide them with a pipeline directly into Syria and other countries in that region to start to build a working class revolutionary movement, or start to make links and help to build such a movement in that part of the world too.
That would counter like the Islamic State and these other Islamic fundamentalist groups. That's
that
a good, interesting point, John.
The working class is a revolutionary alternative mm-hmm. to those groups. And incidentally, you know, during the Arab Spring, I read that in Syria, there were some towns that rose up and built workers' councils.
Mm-hmm.
One person was quoted as saying, this is a revolution of the poor against the rich.
Okay. And the only remnant of that we see is up in the northern part of Syria in Kobani, where I can't remember the name of the group, but they're
the Kurdish group.
The Kurdish group, yes. And I can't think of their name, but they were considered a terrorist group by the Turkish government for decades, and yet they're the only ones that have been able to fight off the Islamic State and at the same time actually build an alternative society, if you will, in the areas they hold, you know, in which women have equal rights to men, and they have, like, workers' councils and all sorts of other, you know, really amazing things, especially considered it's in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's interesting how we've gone from the epicenter of the struggle against austerity, Greece,
mm-hmm.
to events in Kobani,
yeah.
You know, but it really shows how events are so interconnected in this period.
Yes. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Spain coming up here, because I believe there's a similar group of in Spain, a political party, Podemos, who have...
Which we can.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they've had contacts with Syriza. Mm-hmm.
Pretty different. They don't define themselves as being on the left.
Oh, really?
But, yeah. And, I mean, that's the other thing that's in the minds of these different representatives of Eurocapitalism, like Merkel and Hollande and so on, is if we make concessions to Syriza, then that's going to strengthen the struggle against us in countries like Spain and also Portugal.
Which, and this could spread, of course, worldwide, including here to the United States. That'd be an interesting little phenomena if that did happen.
In fact, the Wall Street Journal, some weeks ago, published an editorial in which they said exactly that, and they said...
Really?
If you make concessions to Greece, it's going to sponsor or create illusions in workers all around the world, and they specifically mentioned in voters in the United States.
Well, how interesting. Well, we can only hope, right, John? So, well, listen, thank you for calling in. And that was a really interesting thought there as far as the refugees and immigrants from the Middle East into Greece and all that. And I guess we'll see what happens. But, boy, I tell you, I just don't understand why they had that referendum then. You know, if people voted resoundingly no, why they're now, you know, doing concessions as opposed to having some kind of, you know, a little bit more strengthening bargaining.
Yeah, who knows what was on Tsipras' mind, if he thought that maybe the yes vote would win, or if he thought that this would give him a little bit of bargaining power,
mm-hmm.
or what. But it didn't work out, I think, the way they were thinking. If I could just say, if people are interested in this kind of line of thought, there's a lot of articles along these lines on my blog site, oaklandsocialist.com.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in, John.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Okay, that was another song with the theme of money. I want to thank Bob Pelesny. He put this collection together back in the fall of 2008 when the financial crisis hit, and got some good ones. You know, the OJs were earlier for the Love of Money, and that one was from the Flying Lizards, Money, That's What I Want. And I thought it might be appropriate today since we're talking about austerity and all that and everything. So, Bob, Gus, any comments here in the last few minutes, however long we decide we want to take it?
Well, I think it's interesting to watch the Greek situation in the U.S. stock market, because when they think that the workers are going to win, the U.S. stock market goes down 200 points in a day. And when they think that the austerity programs are going to go through, the stock market goes up 200 points in a day. And it's done that about three or four times here this last week. It's quite interesting to see the effect on the U.S. stock market.
Well, that's a good point. Gus? Mm.
Well, I'm going to take it back to where I was before and really going after this Syriza government. I'm just incredibly disheartened at the positions that they've been taking. Somebody online called it a shameless prostration to the demands of the EU. You know, and I mean, really, when you look at what they've been doing since they took power in January, this is what they've always done. From the very beginning, the Syriza government has sought nothing more than a marginal modification in EU policy. Mm-hmm. What they did was they immediately pledged not to take any unilateral measures to repudiate Greece's $300 billion debt, nor to impose controls to stem the flight of capital from Greek banks. I mean, this is what they do, and this has always been my issue with these so-called leftist groups who take power and claim that they're going to be huge and they're going to be socialists. And John made a very succinct point that was perfect on the money, is that you have these intellectuals who never actually experienced the working class struggle, mm-hmm. who claim to so-called have this radical mindset, and all of a sudden, and they don't understand the day-to-day processes of being a working class person, somebody who's poor, somebody who has to try to survive day-to-day. They are so far removed from that, they think they could just read and be in their ivory tower and they can make decisions. You can't do that. You have to live with the people and live amongst them and understand their crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly the problem that's going on in Greece now. You had a bunch of ideologically sound people who thought that they knew this utopian idea of socialism. Mm-hmm. And if they really read Lenin, they would understand there is no utopian part of it. It is a nasty, grimy, and very complicated world to establish. Mm-hmm. And that's what, and I believe that they've forgotten that very, or that, not that they forgot it, but they never learned the actual message. And that's why you have these horrible measures coming out of this right now. Yeah. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that if Syriza was serious, that the first thing they would have done when they took office was to nationalize the banks and put on capital controls. Because now you see that, you know, I mean, since the no vote especially, but even before, there's been large amounts of capital flight leaving Greece. There's been businesses that shut down.
They limit the amount of money you can take out of your accounts on a daily basis.
It's
over
60
there.
Euros, which is about $70-$75. Yeah. So for an average working person, that's enough to get by. It's people are well off that are screaming about it, you know.
You know, bad, huh?
But nevertheless, I mean, what are they supposed to do? I mean, you know, and the other thing is, I think what came up was interesting, right, leading up to this no vote and a little bit after, just seeing some of the alternative media in this country, is that every TV and radio station in Greece, except for one public station, TV station, one public radio station, are owned by Greek billionaire oligarchs. And that, I guess, leading up to the no vote, they just had non-stop propaganda and outright lies trying to scare the Greek population to vote yes. And I think that's another issue that has to be dealt with, you know. Do you allow, I mean, what right does a billionaire have to own media anyway, especially when they're, basically advertising false information? Looks like we got a caller. Let's see what they have to say. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Jim Iman calling in.
Hi, Jim.
I'm not going to be so critical of Syriza as everybody else is.
Okay.
He's been compared to Odessa, between a rock and a hard place.
Uh-huh.
He inherited a problem.
Yes.
And the banks are controlling it from Brussels, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, there is anger in the entire working class of Europe
mm-hmm.
about losing the state sovereignty being ruled by Brussels.
Yeah.
And it's going to come back. So Syriza inherited this.
Yes.
You know, they're between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm.
The best I think they thought they could do was to, you know, get the debt done. Now they found out that they're not going to move. This is all about regime change. They're not going to negotiate with a left-wing government, whether it's in Spain or Greece or anywhere. They're mm-hmm. not going to do it. That's my comment.
So what about Gus's point? Control. Yeah, I was going to say, Jim, if you want to stay in the line for just a second, what about Gus's sure. point about what he pulled up about the recent offer that Syriza has proposed to the European bankers? That's pure austerity here.
It is.
Mm-hmm. So
here's the problem.
Yeah.
If you go back to the drachma, things are going to get even worse.
Well, that's true, but what's the alternative?
Once they have the money, you know, flowing back in, then those things can be done.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't possible at this time to do it, you know, to just nationalize the banks, you know, and I think one of the reasons Varoufakis quit, you know, they say, well, he was too edgy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he is a Marxist, and he was reading the Riot Act to the foreign ministers. I mean, this is speaking truth to power right in their face.
Mm-hmm.
And he got him pissed off. So it's all about regime change in the final instance.
Okay. Okay, John. Well, I mean, Jim, thank you so much and for calling in with that statement. Okay, well, I don't know. I'm going to have to kind of disagree with Jim. What do you think, Gus? I mean, he's right to a point, but I still think, I mean, you don't fight austerity without, you know, with
exactly.
a little bit of austerity, you
exactly.
know?
Exactly. This is, I mean, especially the stuff about the wages.
Mm-hmm. Pensions, and the pensions.
Attacking pensions and things like that. That doesn't solve the problem. All it does is it digs a deeper hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a historical trend. And, you know, so let's look at this from a long-term perspective.
Okay.
What's going to happen if that they approve these measures that Syriza government has offered people? This is going to actually lead to the most, the biggest widening of income inequality across the world. Right now, there's a report that came out, and I want to make sure I get this right, from the University of California, Berkeley, and they say that right now, according to the report, the top 1% of income earned increased their share of total income from 20.1% in 2013 to 21.2% in 2014. So the income shares of the highest earning 10%, 1%, and 0.1% of income earners all grew in 2014. The top 10% of earners received 49.9% of income in 2014, more than any other year besides 2012. So what's going to end up happening here is if they do what we were talking about with France and Germany, and they do start cutting these wages, what exactly is going to happen to the bottom 99% of the people? I mean, seriously, we're talking about having the rug pulled out from underneath you. They're already in a very deep, you could call it a depression based on the Western standards of it, but it's going to be even worse. It's going to be crippling to the point of a possible hunger issue.
Yes.
I mean, seriously, like, this is really scary that this is the kind of response that Syriza put forth. Not only do you have demonstrations going on where hundreds of thousands of workers are marching in the streets to no austerity, but you put forth the plan that has austerity in it after seeing the masses of people arguing against it. That just shows a lack of respect.
And vote against it, you know, yeah, by a big margin. You
exactly.
know.
That shows a lack of respect for your people and also a lack of respect for the movement of so-called Marxism or, you know, it's just a working class movement.
I think at very best, what you just said and what I've seen in the past here with Syriza is that they're trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Exactly.
You know?
And you can't do that
can't
in
do
capitalism.
That
doesn't work.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supporting Community Radio Station WT in Champaign, Illinois. And we're going to leave you with a little music by Patti Smith. And then stay tuned for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.